Part 3. In this haze of green and gold. Vescagan. Chapter 1. Mrs. Tessenbaum drives south. 1. The fact of his own almost unearthly speed of hand never occurred to Jake Chambers. All he knew was that when he staggered out of the Divar toy and back into America, his shirt, belled out into a pregnant curve by Oi's weight, was pulling out of his jeans. The bumbler, who never had much luck when it came to passing between the worlds, he'd nearly been squashed by a taxicab the last time, tumbled free. Almost anyone else in the world would have been unable to prevent that fall, and in fact it very likely wouldn't have hurt Oi at all, but Jake wasn't almost anyone. Ka had wanted him so badly that it had even found its way around death to put him at Roland's side. Now his hands shot out with a speed so great that they momentarily blurred away to nothing. When they reappeared, one was curled into the thick shag at the nape of Oi's neck, and the other into the shorter fur at the rump end of his long back. Jake set his friend down on the pavement. Oi looked up at him and gave a single, short bark. It seemed to express not one idea but two, thanks and don't do that again. "Come on," Roland said, "we have to hurry." Jake followed him toward the store, Oi falling in at his accustomed place by the boy's left heel. There was a sign hanging in the door from a little rubber suction cup. It read, "We're open, so come in and visit," just as it had in 1977. Taped in the window to the left of the door was this, "Come one, come all, to the First Congregational Church, Beanhole Bean Supper. Saturday, June 19th, 1999. Intersection Route 7 and Clatt Road. Parish House, in back, 5 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. At First Congo, we're always glad to see ya, neighbor." Jake thought, the bean supper will be starting in an hour or so. They'll already be putting down the tablecloths and setting the places. Taped to the right of the door was a more startling message to the public. "First Lovell Stoneham Church of the Walk-ins. Will you join us for worship? Sunday services, 10 a.m. Thursday services, 7 p.m. Every Wednesday is youth night, 7 to 9 p.m. Games, music, scripture, and news of walk-ins. Hey, teens, be there or be square. We seek the doorway to heaven. Will you seek with us?" Jake found himself thinking of Harrigan, the street preacher on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 46th Street, and wondering to which of these two churches he might have been attracted. His head might have told him First Congo, but his heart— "Hurry, Jake," Roland repeated, and there was a jingle as the gunslinger opened the door. Good smells wafted out, reminding Jake, as they had reminded Eddie, of Took's on Makala High Street. Coffee and peppermint candy, tobacco and salami, olive oil, the salty tang of brine, sugar and spice, and most things nice. He followed Roland into the store, aware that he had brought at least two things with him after all. The coyote machine pistol was stuffed into the waistband of his jeans, and the bag of arisers was still slung over his shoulder, hanging on his left side, so that the half a dozen plates remaining inside would be within easy reach of his right hand. 2. Wendell Chip McAvoy was at the deli counter, weighing up a pretty sizable order of sliced honey-cured turkey for Mrs. Tessenbaum, and until the bell over the door rang, once more turning Chip's life upside down, "You've turned turtle," the old-timers used to say when your car rolled in the ditch, they had been discussing the growing presence of jet skis on Key Wadden Pond, or rather, Mrs. Tessenbaum had been discussing it. Chip thought Mrs. T was a more or less typical summer visitor. Rich as Croesus, or at least her husband, who had one of those new dot-com businesses, was. Gabby as a parrot loaded on whiskey, and as crazy as Howard Hughes on a morphine toot. She could afford a cabin cruiser, and 24 jet skis to pull it if she fancied, but she came down to the market on this end of the lake in a battered old rowboat, tying up right about where John Cullum used to tie his up. Until that day, as the years had refined his story to ever greater purity, burnishing it like an oft-polished piece of teak furniture, Chip had come more and more to convey its capital-letter status with his voice, speaking of that day in the same reverential tones the Reverend Convey used when speaking of our Lord. La Tassenbaum was talky, meddlesome, good-looking, kinder, he supposed, if you didn't mind the makeup and the hairspray, loaded with green, and a Republican. Under the circumstances, Chip McAvoy felt perfectly justified in sneaking his thumb onto the corner of the scale, a trick he had learned from his father, who had told him you practically had a duty to rook folks from away if they could afford it. But you must never rook folks from the home place, not even if they were as rich as that writer King from over in Lovell. Why? Because word got around, and the next thing you knew, out-of-town custom was all a man had to get by on, and try doing that in the month of February when the snowbanks on the sides of Route 7 were 9 feet high. This wasn't February, however, and Mrs. Tassenbaum, a daughter of Abraham, if he had ever seen one, was not from these parts. No, Mrs. Tassenbaum and her rich-as-Croesus.com husband would be gone back to New York as soon as they saw the first colored leaf fall. Which was why he felt perfectly comfortable in turning her $6 order of turkey into $7.80 with the ball of his thumb on the scale. Nor did it hurt to agree with her when she switched topics and started talking about what a terrible man that Bill Clinton was. Although, in fact, Chip had voted twice for Bubba, and would have voted for him a third time, had the Constitution allowed him to run for another term. Bubba was smart. He was good at persuading the ragheads to do what he wanted. He hadn't entirely forgotten the working man, and by the Lord Harry, he got more pussy than a toilet seat. "And now Gore expects to just ride in on his coattails," Mrs. Tassenbaum said, digging for her checkbook. The turkey on the scale magically gained another 2 ounces, and there Chip felt it prudent to lock it in. "Claims he invented the Internet. Huh, I know better. In fact, I know the man who really did invent the Internet." She looked up, Chip's thumb now nowhere near the scales. He had an instinct about such things, damned if he didn't, and gave Chip a roguish little smile. She lowered her voice into its confidential, just we two register. "I ought to. I've been sleeping in the same bed with him for almost 20 years. Chip gave a hearty laugh, took the sliced turkey off the scale, and put it on a piece of white paper. He was glad to leave the subject of jet skis behind, as he had one on order from Viking Motors, the boys with the toys, in Oxford himself. "I know what you mean. That fella Gore, too slick." Mrs. Tassenbaum was nodding enthusiastically, and so Chip decided to lay on a little more. Never hurt, by Christ. "His hair, for instance. How can you trust a man who puts that much goo in his—" That was when the bell over the door jingled. Chip looked up, saw, and froze. A goddamned lot of water had gone under the bridge since that day, but Wendell Chip McAvoy knew the man who'd caused all the trouble the moment he stepped through the door. Some faces you simply never forgot. And hadn't he always known, deep in his heart's most secret place, that the man with the terrible blue eyes hadn't finished his business and would be back? Back for him? That idea broke his paralysis. Chip turned and ran. He got no more than 3 steps along the inside of the counter before a shot rang out, loud as thunder, in the store. The place was bigger and fancier than it had been in 77, thank God for his father's insistence on extravagant insurance coverage, and Mrs. Tassenbaum uttered a piercing scream. 3 or 4 people who had been browsing the aisles turned with expressions of astonishment, and one of them hit the floor in a dead faint. Chip had time to register that it was Rhoda Beamer, eldest daughter of one of the 2 women who'd been killed in Huron that day. Then it seemed to him that time had folded back on itself, and it was Ruth herself lying there with a can of creamed corn rolling free of one relaxing hand. He heard a bullet buzz over his head like an angry bee and skidded to a stop, hands raised. "Don't shoot, mister," he heard himself bawl in the thin, wavering voice of an old man. "Take whatever's in the register, but don't shoot me." "Turn around," said the voice of the man who had turned Chip's world turtle on that day. The man who'd almost gotten him killed. He'd been in the hospital over in Bridgeton for 2 weeks by the living Jesus, and had now reappeared like an old monster from some child's closet. "The rest of you on the floor.
But you turn around, shopkeeper. Turn around and see me. See me very well.
3. The man swayed from side to side, and for a moment Roland thought he would faint instead of turning. Perhaps some survival-oriented part of his brain suggested that fainting was more likely to get him killed, for the shopkeeper managed to keep his feet and did finally turn and face the gunslinger. His dress was eerily similar to what he'd been wearing the last time Roland was here. It could have been the same black tie and butcher's apron tied up high on his midriff. His hair was still slicked back along his skull, but now it was wholly white, instead of salt and pepper. Roland remembered the way blood had dashed back from the left side of the shopkeeper's temple as a bullet, one fired by Andolini himself, for all the gunslinger knew, grooved him. Now there was a grayish knot of scar tissue there. Roland guessed the man combed his hair in a way that would display that mark rather than hide it. He'd either had a fool's luck that day or been saved by Ka. Roland thought Ka the more likely. Judging from the sick look of recognition in the shopkeeper's eyes, he thought so too.
"Do you have a cartomobile? A truckomobile or a taxi?" Roland asked, holding the barrel of his gun on the shopkeeper's middle.
Jake stepped up beside Roland. "What are you driving?" he asked the shopkeeper. "That's what he means." "Truck," the shopkeeper managed. "International Harvester pickup. It's outside in the lot." He reached under his apron so suddenly that Roland came within an ace of shooting him. The shopkeeper, mercifully, didn't seem to notice. All of the store's customers were now lying prone, including the woman who'd been at the counter. Roland could smell the meat she had been in the process of trading for, and his stomach rumbled. He was tired, hungry, overloaded with grief, and there were too many things to think about, too many by far. His mind couldn't keep up. Jake would have said he needed to take a time out, but he didn't see any time outs in their immediate future. The shopkeeper was holding out a set of keys. His fingers were trembling and the keys jingled. The late afternoon sun, slanting in the windows, struck them and bounced complicated reflections into the gunslinger's eyes. First, the man in the white apron had plunged a hand out of sight without asking permission, and not slowly. Now this, holding up a bunch of reflective metal objects as if to blind his adversary. It was as if he were trying to get killed. But it had been that way on the day of the ambush, too, hadn't it? The storekeeper, quicker on his feet then, and without that widower's hump in his back, had followed him and Eddie from place to place like a cat who won't stop getting under your feet, seemingly oblivious to the bullets flying all around them, just as he'd seemed oblivious of the one that grooved the side of his head. At one point, Roland remembered, he had talked about his son, almost like a man in a barbershop making conversation while he waits his turn to sit under the scissors. A Ka-Mai, then, and such were often safe from harm, at least until Ka tired of their antics and swatted them out of the world.
"Take the truck, take it and go," the shopkeeper was telling him. "It's yours, I'm giving it to you, really."
"If you don't stop flashing those damned keys in my eyes, Sai, what I'll take is your breath," Roland said.
There was another clock behind the counter. He had already noticed that this world was full of clocks, as if the people who lived here thought that by having so many they could cage time. 4:10, which meant they'd been America's side for 9 minutes already. Time was racing, racing. Somewhere nearby, Stephen King was almost certainly on his afternoon walk, and in desperate danger, although he didn't know it. Or had it happened already? Roland, anyway, had always assumed that the writer's death would hit them hard like another beamquake, but maybe not. Maybe the impact of his death would be more gradual.
"How far from here to Turtleback Lane?" Roland rapped at the storekeeper.
The elderly Sai only stared, eyes huge and liquid with terror. Never in his life had Roland felt more like shooting a man, or at least pistol-whipping him. He looked as foolish as a goat with its foot stuck in a crevice. Then the woman lying in front of the meat counter spoke. She was looking up at Roland and Jake, her hands clasped together at the small of her back.
"That's in Lovell, mister. It's about 5 miles from here."
One look in her eyes, large and brown, fearful but not panicky, and Roland decided this was the one he wanted, not the storekeeper. Unless that was...
He turned to Jake. Can you drive the shopkeeper's truck 5 miles? Roland saw the boy wanting to say yes, then realizing he couldn't afford to risk ultimate failure by trying to do a thing he, city boy that he was, had never done in his life.
No, Jake said. I don't think so. What about you?
Roland had watched Eddie drive John Cullum's car. It didn't look that hard. But there was his hip to consider. Rosa had told him that dry twist moved fast, like a fire driven by strong winds, she'd said. And now he knew what she'd meant. On the trail into Colibrin Sturgis, the pain in his hip had been no more than an occasional twinge. Now it was as if the socket had been injected with red-hot lead, then wrapped in strands of barbed wire. The pain radiated all the way down his leg to the right ankle. He'd watched how Eddie manipulated the pedals, going back and forth between the one that made the car speed up and the one that made it slow down, always using the right foot, which meant the ball of the right hip was always rolling in its socket. He didn't think he could do that, not with any degree of safety.
I think not, he said.
He took the keys from the shopkeeper, then looked at the woman lying in front of the meat counter.
Stand up, Sire, he said.
Mrs. Tassenbaum did as she was told, and when she was on her feet, Roland gave her the keys.
I keep meeting useful people in here, he thought. If this one's as good as Cullum turned out to be, we might still be all right. You're going to drive my young friend and meet a Lovell, Roland said.
To Turtleback Lane, she said.
You say true. I say thank you.
Are you going to kill me after you get to where you want to go?
Not unless you dawdle, Roland said.
She considered this, then nodded.
Then I won't. Let's go.
Good luck, Mrs. Tassenbaum,
the shopkeeper told her faintly as she started for the door.
If I don't come back, she said, you just remember one thing. It was my husband who invented the Internet, him and his friends, partly at Caltech and partly in their own garages, not Albert Gore.
Roland's stomach rumbled again. He reached over the counter. The shopkeeper cringed away from him as if he suspected Roland of carrying the red plague, grabbed the woman's pile of turkey, and folded 3 slices into his mouth. The rest he handed to Jake, who ate 2 slices and then looked down at Oi, who was looking up at the meat with great interest.
I'll give you your share when we get in the truck, Jake promised.
Frock,
Oi said, then, with much greater emphasis,
share.
Holy jumping Jesus Christ, the shopkeeper said.
4. The Yankee shopkeeper's accent might have been cute, but his truck wasn't. It was a standard shift, for one thing. Irene Tassenbaum of Manhattan hadn't driven a standard since she had been Irene Cantora of Staten Island. It was also a stick shift, and she had never driven one of those. Jake was sitting beside her with his feet placed around said stick, and Oi still chewing turkey on his lap. Roland swung into the passenger seat, trying not to snarl at the pain in his leg. Irene forgot to depress the clutch when she keyed the ignition. The IH lurched forward, then stalled. Luckily, it had been rolling the roads of western Maine since the mid-60s, and it was the sedate jump of an elderly mare rather than the spirited buck of a colt. Otherwise, Chip McAvoy would once more have lost at least one of his plate-glass windows. Oi scrabbled for balance on Jake's lap and sprayed out a mouthful of turkey along with a word he had learned from Eddie. Irene stared at the bumbler with wide, startled eyes.
Did that creature just say fuck, young man? Never mind what he said, Jake replied. His voice was shaking. The hands of the boar's head clock in the window now stood at 5 to 4. Like Roland, the boy had never had a sense of time as a thing so little in their control. Use the clutch and get us out of here.
Luckily, the shifting pattern had been embossed on the head of the stick shift and was still faintly visible. Mrs. Tassenbaum pushed in the clutch with a sneakered foot, ground the gears hellishly, and finally found reverse. The truck backed out onto Route 7 in a series of jerks, then stalled halfway across the white line. She turned the ignition key, realizing she'd once more forgotten the clutch, just a little too late to prevent another series of those spastic leaps. Roland and Jake were now bracing their hands against the dusty metal dashboard, where a faded sticker proclaimed, "America, love it or leave," in red, white, and blue. This series of jerks was actually a good thing, for at that moment, a truck loaded with logs. It was impossible for Roland not to think of the one that had crashed the last time they'd been here.
crested the rise to the north of the store. Had the pickup not jerked its way back into the general store's parking lot, bashing the fender of a parked car as it came to a stop, they would have been center-punched, and very likely killed. The logging truck swerved, horn blaring, rear wheels spewing up dust. The creature in the boy's lap, it looked to Mrs. Tassenbaum like some weird mixture of dog and raccoon, barked again. Fuck! She was almost sure of it. The storekeeper and the other patrons were lined up on the other side of the glass, and she suddenly knew what a fish in an aquarium must feel like.
"Lady, can you drive this thing or not?"
the boy yelled. He had some sort of bag over his shoulder. It reminded her of a newsboy's bag, only it was leather instead of canvas, and there appeared to be plates inside.
"I can drive it, young man, don't you worry."
She was terrified, and yet at the same time, was she enjoying this? She almost thought she was. For the last 18 years, she'd been little more than the great David Tassenbaum's ornament, a supporting character in his increasingly famous life, the lady who said, "Try one of these," as she passed around hors d'oeuvres at parties. Now, suddenly, she was at the center of something, and she had an idea it was something very important indeed.
"Take a deep breath," said the man with the hard, sunburned face.
His brilliant blue eyes fastened upon hers, and when they did, it was hard to think of anything else. Also, the sensation was pleasant. If this is hypnosis, she thought, they ought to teach it in the public schools.
"Hold it, then let it out, and then drive us for your father's sake."
She pulled in a deep breath as instructed, and suddenly the day seemed brighter, nearly brilliant. And she could hear faint singing voices, lovely voices. Was the truck's radio on, tuned to some opera program? No time to check, but it was nice, whatever it was, as calming as the deep breath. Mrs. Tassenbaum pushed in the clutch and restarted the engine. This time, she found reverse on the first try and backed into the road almost smoothly. Her first effort at a forward gear netted her second instead of first, and the truck almost stalled when she eased the clutch out, but then the engine seemed to take pity on her. With a wheeze of loose pistons and a manic rapping from beneath the hood, they began rolling north toward the Stoneham-Lovell line.
"Do you know where Turtleback Lane is?" Roland asked her.
Ahead of them, near a sign marked Million Dollar Campground, a battered blue minivan swung out onto the road.
"Yes," she said.
"You're sure?"
The last thing the gunslinger wanted was to waste precious time casting about for the back road where King lived.
"Yes, we have friends who live there, the Beckharts."
For a moment, Roland could only grope, knowing he'd heard the name but not where. Then he got it. Beckhart was the name of the man who owned the cabin where he and Eddie had had their final palaver with John Cullum. He felt a fresh stab of grief in his heart at the thought of Eddie as he'd been on that thundery afternoon, still so strong and vital.
"All right," he said, "I believe you."
She glanced at him across the boy sitting between.
"You're in one hell of a hurry, mister, like the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. What very important date are you almost too late for?"
Roland shook his head. "Never mind, just drive."
He looked at the clock on the dashboard, but it didn't work, had stopped in the long ago with the hands pointed at, of course, 9:19.
"It may not be too late yet," he said,
while ahead of them, unheeded, the blue van began to pull away. It strayed across the white line of Route 7 into the southbound lane, and Mrs. Tassenbaum almost committed a bon mot, something about people who started drinking before 5, but then the blue van pulled back into the northbound lane, breasted the next hill, and was gone toward the town of Lovell. Mrs. Tassenbaum forgot about it. She had more interesting things to think about. For instance,
"You don't have to answer what I'm going to ask now if you don't want to," she said. "But I admit that I'm curious."
5. Brian Smith has spent the last couple of nights, along with his Rottweilers, litter twins he has named Bullet and Pistol, in the Million Dollar Campground just over the Lovell-Stoneham line. It's nice there by the river. The locals call the rickety wooden structure spanning the water Million Dollar Bridge, which Brian understands is a joke and a pretty funny one, by God. Also, folks, hippie types down from the woods in Sweden, Harrison, and Waterford mostly, sometimes show up there with drugs to sell. Brian likes to get mellow, likes to get down, may it do you, and he's down this Saturday afternoon. Not a lot, not the way he likes, but enough to give him a good case of the munchies. They have those Mars's bars at the center level store. Nothing better for the munchies than those. He pulls out of the campground and onto Route 7 without so much as a glance in either direction, then says, "Whoops, forgot again." No traffic, though. Later on, especially after the 4th of July and until Labor Day, there'll be plenty of traffic to contend with, even out here in the boonies, and he'll probably stay closer to home. He knows he isn't much of a driver. One more speeding ticket or fender bender, and he'll probably lose his license for 6 months. Again. No problem this time, though. Nothing coming but an old pick-em-up, and that baby's almost half a mile back. "Eat my dust, cowboy," he says, and giggles. He doesn't know why he said cowboy, when the word in his mind was motherfucker, as in "eat my dust, motherfucker," but it sounds good. It sounds right. He sees he's drifted into the other lane and corrects his course. "Back on the road again," he cries, and lets loose another high-pitched giggle. "Back on the road again" is a good one, and he always uses it on girls. Another good one is when you twist the wheel from side to side, making your car loop back and forth, and you say, "Ah, geez, must have had too much cough syrup." He knows lots of lines like this. Even once thought of writing a book called Crazy Road Jokes. Wouldn't that be a sketch? Brian Smith writing a book just like that guy King over in Lovell. He turns on the radio. The van, yawing onto the soft shoulder to the left of the Tarvey, throwing up a rooster tail of dust, but not quite running into the ditch, and gets Steely Dan singing Hey 19. Good one. Yes, a wicked good one. He drives a little faster in response to the music. He looks into the rearview mirror and sees his dogs, Bullet and Pistol, looking over the rear seat bright-eyed. For a moment, Brian thinks they're looking at him, maybe thinking what a good guy he is, then wonders how he can be so stupid. There's a styrofoam cooler behind the driver's seat and a pound of fresh hamburger in it. He means to cook it later over a campfire back at Million Dollar. Yes, and a couple more Mars's bars for dessert, by the hairy old Jesus. Mars's bars are wicked good. "You boys never mind that cooler," Brian Smith says, speaking to the dogs he can see in the rearview mirror. This time, the minivan pitches instead of yawing, crossing the white line as it climbs a blind grade at 50 miles an hour. Luckily, or unluckily, depending on your point of view, nothing is coming the other way. Nothing puts a stop to Brian Smith's northward progress. "You never mind that hamburg, that's my supper," he says, supper as John Cullum would, but the face looking back at the bright-eyed dogs from the rearview mirror is the face of Shimi Ruiz, almost exactly. Shimi could be Brian Smith's litter twin. 6. Irene Tassenbaum was driving the truck with more assurance now, standard shift or not. She almost wished she didn't have to turn right a quarter of a mile from here, because that would necessitate using the clutch again, this time to downshift. But that was Turtleback Lane right up ahead, and Turtleback was where these boys wanted to go. Walk-ins. They said so, and she believed it. But who else would? Chip McAvoy, maybe. And surely the Reverend Peterson from that crazy church of the walk-ins down in Stoneham Corners. But anyone else? Her husband, for instance? Nope. Never. If you couldn't engrave a thing on a microchip, David Tassenbaum didn't believe it was real. She wondered, not for the first time lately, if 47 was too old to think about a divorce. She shifted back to second, without grinding the gears too much, but then, as she turned off the highway, had to shift all the way down to first when the silly old pickup began to grunt and chug. She thought that one of her passengers would make some sort of smart comment. Perhaps the boy's mutant dog would even say fuck again, but all the man in the passenger seat said was, "This doesn't look the same." "When were you here last?" Irene Tassenbaum asked him. She considered shifting up to second gear again, then decided to leave things just as they were. "If it ain't broke, don't fix it," David liked to say. "It's been a while," the man admitted. She had to keep sneaking glances at him. There was something strange and exotic about him, especially his eyes. It was as if they'd seen things she'd never even dreamed of. "Stop it," she told herself. "He's probably a drugstore cowboy all the way from Portsmouth, New Hampshire." But she kind of doubted that. The boy was odd as well, him and his exotic cross-breed dog. But they were nothing compared to the man with the haggard face and the strange blue eyes. "Eddie said it was a loop," the boy said. "Maybe last time you guys came in from the other end." The man considered this and nodded.
"Would the other end be the Bridgeton end?" he asked the woman.
"Yes, indeed."
The man with the odd blue eyes nodded. "We're going to the writer's house."
"Kara laughs," she said at once. "It's a beautiful house. I've seen it from the lake. But I don't know which driveway."
"It's 19, the man said. They were currently passing the one marked 27. From this end of Turtleback Lane, the numbers would go down rather than up.
"What do you want with him, if I may be so bold?"
It was the boy who answered.
"We want to save his life."
7. Roland recognized the steeply descending driveway at once. Even though he'd last seen it under black, thundery skies, and much of his attention had been taken by the brilliant flying Tahine. There was no sign of Tahine or other exotic wildlife today. The roof of the house below had been dressed with copper instead of shingles at some point during the intervening years, and the wooded area beyond it had become a lawn, but the driveway was the same, with a sign reading, "Kara Laughs," on the left-hand side and one bearing the number 19 in large numerals on the right. Beyond was the lake, sparkling blue in the strong afternoon light. From the lawn came the blat of a hard-working small engine. Roland looked at Jake and was dismayed by the boy's pale cheeks and wide, frightened eyes.
"What? What's wrong?"
"He's not here, Roland. Not him, not any of his family, just the man cutting the grass."
"Nonsense, you can't—"
Mrs. Tassenbaum began.
"I know," Jake shouted at her. "I know, lady."
Roland was looking at Jake with a frank and horrified sort of fascination. But in his current state, the boy either did not understand the look or missed it entirely.
"Why are you lying, Jake?" the gunslinger thought. And then on the heels of that, "He's not."
"What if it's already happened?"
Jake demanded. And yes, he was worried about King, but Roland didn't think that was all he was worried about.
"What if he's dead and his family's not here because the police called them and—"
"It hasn't happened,"
Roland said, but that was all of which he was sure.
"What do you know, Jake, and why won't you tell me?"
There was no time to wonder about it now. 8. The man with the blue eyes sounded calm as he spoke to the boy, but he didn't look calm to Irene Tassenbaum, not at all. And those singing voices she'd first noticed outside the East Stoneham General Store had changed. Their song was still sweet, but wasn't there a note of desperation in it now as well? She thought so. A high, pleading quality that made her temples throb.
"How can you know that?"
the boy called Jake shouted at the man. His father, she assumed.
"How can you be so fucking sure?"
Instead of answering the kid's question, the one called Roland looked at her. Mrs. Tassenbaum felt the skin of her arms and back break out in goose flesh.
"Drive down, Si, may it do you."
She looked doubtfully at the steep slope of the Kara Laughs driveway.
"If I do, I might not get this bucket of bolts back up."
"You'll have to," Roland said.
9. The man cutting the grass was King's bondservant, Roland surmised, or whatever passed for such in this world. He was white-haired under his straw hat, but straight-backed and hale, wearing his years with little effort. When the truck drove down the steep driveway to the house, the man paused with one arm resting on the handle of the mower. When the passenger door opened and the gunslinger got out, he used the switch to turn the mower off. He also removed his hat, without being exactly aware that he was doing it, Roland thought. Then his eyes registered the gun that hung at Roland's hip and widened enough to make the crow's feet around them disappear.
"Howdy, mister,"
he said cautiously.
He thinks I'm a walk-in, Roland thought, just as she did.
And they were walk-ins of a sort, he and Jake. They just happened to have come to a time and place where such things were common, and where time was racing.
Roland spoke before the man could go on. Where are they? Where is he, Stephen King? Speak, man, and tell me the truth.
The hat slipped from the old man's relaxing fingers and fell beside his feet on the newly cut grass. His hazel eyes stared into Roland's, fascinated, the bird looking at the snake.
"Family's across the lake at that place they got on t'other side," he said. "T'old Schindler place. Having some kind of party, they are. Steve said he'd drive over after his walk."
And he gestured to a small black car parked on the driveway extension, its nose just visible around the side of the house.
"Where is he walking? Do you know? Tell this lady."
The old man looked briefly over Roland's shoulder, then back to the gunslinger.
"Be easier was I to drive you there myself."
Roland considered this, but only briefly. Easier to begin with, yes. Maybe harder on the other end, where King would either be saved or lost. Because they'd found the woman in Cause Road. However minor a role she might have to play, it was her they had found first on the path of the beam. In the end, it was as simple as that. As for the size of her part, it was better not to judge such things in advance. Hadn't he and Eddie believed John Cullum, met in that same roadside store some 3 wheels north of here, would have but a minor role to play in their story? Yet it had turned out to be anything but. All of this crossed his consciousness in less than a second. Information, hunch, Eddie would have called it, delivered in a kind of brilliant mental shorthand. "No," he said, and jerked a thumb back over his shoulder. "Tell her, now."
10.
The boy, Jake, had fallen back against the seat with his hands lying limp at his sides. The peculiar dog was looking anxiously up into the kid's face, but the kid didn't see him. His eyes were closed, and Irene Tassenbaum at first thought he'd fainted.
"Son? Jake?" "I have him," the boy said without opening his eyes. "Not Stephen King, I can't touch him, but the other one. I have to slow him down. How can I slow him down?"
Mrs. Tassenbaum had listened to her husband enough at work, holding long, muttered dialogues with himself, to know a self-directed inquiry when she heard one. Also, she had no idea of whom the boy was speaking, only that it wasn't Stephen King, which left about 6 billion other possibilities, globally speaking. Nevertheless, she did answer because she knew what always slowed her down.
"Too bad he doesn't need to go to the bathroom," she said.
11.
Strawberries aren't out in Maine, not this early in the season. But there are raspberries. Justine Anderson of Maybrook, New York, and Elvira Toothaker, her Lovell friend, are walking along the side of Route 7, which Elvira still calls the Old Freiburg Road, with their plastic buckets harvesting from the bushes which run for at least half a mile along the old rock wall. Garrett McKean built that wall 100 years ago, and it is to Garrett's great-grandson that Roland Deschain of Gilead is speaking at this very moment. Ka is a wheel, do you not ken it? The two women have enjoyed their hour's walk, not because either of them has any great love of raspberries. Justine reckons she won't even eat hers, the seeds get caught in her teeth. But because it's given them a chance to catch up on their respective families and to laugh a little together about the years when their friendship was new and probably the most important thing in either girl's life. They met at Vassar College, 1,000 years ago, so it does seem, and carried the daisy chain together at graduation the year they were juniors. This is what they are talking about when the blue minivan, it is a 1985 Dodge Caravan, Justine recognizes the make and model because her oldest son had one just like it when his tribe started growing, comes around the curve by Melder's German restaurant and Brathaus. It's all over the road, looping from side to side, first spuming up dust from the southbound shoulder, then plunging giddily across the tar and spuming up more from the northbound one. The second time it does this, rolling toward them now and coming at a pretty damned good clip, Justine thinks it may actually go into the ditch and turn over, turned turtle, they used to say back in the 40s when she and Elvira had been at Vassar, but the driver hauls it back on the road just before that can happen.
Look out, that person's drunk or something, Justine says, alarmed.
She pulls Elvira back, but they find their way blocked by the old wall with its dressing of raspberry bushes. The thorns catch at their slacks. Thank goodness neither of us was wearing shorts, Justine will think later when she has time to think, and pull out little puffs of cloth. Justine is thinking she should put an arm around her friend's shoulder and tumble them both over the thigh-high wall, do a backflip, just like in gym class all those years ago. But before she can make up her mind to do it, the blue van is by them, and at the moment it passes, it's more or less on the road and not a danger to them. Justine watches it go by, in a muffled blare of rock music, her heart thumping heavily in her chest, the taste of something her body has dumped, adrenaline would be the most likely possibility, flat and metallic on her tongue. And halfway up the hill, the little blue van once again lurches across the white line. The driver corrects the drift, no, overcorrects. Once more, the blue van is on the right-hand shoulder, spuming up yellow dust for 50 yards.
Gosh, I hope Stephen King sees that asshole, Elvira says.
They have passed the writer half a mile or so back and said hello. Probably everyone in town has seen him on his afternoon walk, at one time or another. As if the driver of the blue van has heard Elvira Toothaker call him an asshole, the van's brake lights flare. The van suddenly pulls all the way off the road and stops. When the door opens, the ladies hear a louder blast of rock and roll music. They also hear the driver, a man, yelling at someone. Elvira and Justine just pity the person stuck driving with that guy on such a beautiful June afternoon. "You leave that alone," he shouts. "That ain't yours, you hear?" And then the driver reaches back into the van, brings out a cane, and uses it to help him over the rock wall and into the bushes. The van sits, rumbling on the soft shoulder, driver's door open, emitting blue exhaust from one end and rock from the other.
"What's he doing?"
Justine asks, a little nervously.
"Taking a leak would be my guess," her friend replies. "But if Mr. King back there is lucky, maybe doing number two instead, that might give him time to get off Route 7 and back onto Turtleback Lane."
Suddenly, Justine doesn't feel like picking berries anymore. She wants to go back home and have a strong cup of tea. The man comes limping briskly out of the bushes and uses his cane to help him back over the rock wall.
"I guess he didn't need to number two," Elvira says, and as the bad driver climbs back into his blue van, the two going-on old women look at each other and burst into giggles.
12. Roland watched the old man give the woman instructions, something about using Warrington's Road as a shortcut, and then Jake opened his eyes. To Roland, the boy looked unutterably weary.
"I was able to make him stop and take a leak," he said. "Now he's fixing something behind his seat. I don't know what it is, but it won't keep him busy for long. Roland, this is bad. We're awfully late. We have to go."
Roland looked at the woman, hoping that his decision not to replace her behind the wheel with the old man had been the right one.
"Do you know where to go? Do you understand?"
"Yes," she said. "Up Warrington's to Route 7. We sometimes go to dinner at Warrington's. I know that road."
"Can't guarantee you'll cut his path going that way," said the caretaker, "but it seems likely."
He bent down to pick up his hat and began to brush bits of freshly cut grass from it. He did this with long, slow strokes, like a man caught in a dream.
Seems likely to me."
And then, still like a man who dreams awake, he tucked his hat beneath his arm, raised a fist to his forehead, and bent a leg to the stranger with the big revolver on his hip. Why would he not? The stranger was surrounded by white light.
13.
When Roland pulled himself back into the cab of the storekeeper's truck, a chore made more difficult by the rapidly escalating pain in his right hip, his hand came down on Jake's leg, and just like that, he knew what Jake had been keeping back and why. He had been afraid that knowing might cause the gunslinger's focus to drift. It was not Khashoggi the boy had felt, or Roland would have felt it too. How could there be Khashoggi among them with the tet already broken? Their special power, something greater than all of them, perhaps drawn from the beam itself, was gone.
Now they were just three friends, four counting the bumbler, united by a single purpose. And they could save King. Jake knew it. They could save the writer and come a step closer to saving the tower by doing so. But one of them was going to die doing it. Jake knew that, too. 14. An old saying, one taught to him by his father, came to Roland then. If Ka will say so, let it be so. Yes, all right. Let it be so. During the long years he had spent on the trail of the Men in Black, the gunslinger would have sworn nothing in the universe could have caused him to renounce the tower. Had he not literally killed his own mother in pursuit of it back at the start of his terrible career? But in those years he had been friendless, childless, and, he didn't like to admit it, but it was true, heartless. He had been bewitched by that cold romance, the loveless mistake for love. Now he had a son, and he had been given a second chance, and he had changed. Knowing that one of them must die in order to save the writer, that their fellowship must be reduced again and so soon, would not make him cry off. But he would make sure that Roland of Gilead, not Jake of New York, provided the sacrifice this time. Did the boy know that he'd penetrated his secret? No time to worry about that now. Roland slammed the truckomobile's door shut and looked at the woman. "Is your name Irene?" he asked. She nodded. "Drive, Irene. Do it as if Lord High Splitfoot were on your trail with rape on his mind, do you, I beg? Out Warrington's Road. If we don't see him there, out the Severn Road. Will you?"
"You're fucking right,"
said Mrs. Tassenbaum, and shoved the gear shift into first with real authority. The engine screamed, but the truck began to roll backward as if so frightened by the job ahead that it would rather finish up in the lake. Then she engaged the clutch, and the old International Harvester leaped ahead, charging up the steep incline of the driveway and leaving a trail of blue smoke and burnt rubber behind. Garrett McKean's great-grandson watched them go with his mouth hanging open. He had no idea what had just happened, but he felt sure that a great deal depended on what would happen next. Maybe everything. 15. Needing to piss that bad was weird, because pissing was the last thing Brian Smith had done before leaving the million-dollar campground. And once he'd clambered over the fucking rock wall, he hadn't been able to manage more than a few drops, even though it had felt like a real bladder buster at the time. Brian hopes he's not going to have trouble with his prostrate. Trouble with the old prostrate is the last thing he needs. He's got enough other problems by the hairy old Jesus. Oh well, now that he's stopped, he might as well try to fix the styrofoam cooler behind the seat. The dogs are still staring at it with their tongues hanging out. He tries to wedge it underneath the seat, but it won't go. There's not quite enough clearance. What he does instead is to point a dirty finger at his rotties and tell them again to ne'er mind the cooler and the meat inside. That's his. That's going to be his supper. This time he even thinks to add a promise that later on he'll mix a little of the hamburger in with their Purina, if they're good. This is fairly deep thinking for Brian Smith. But the simple expedient of swinging the cooler up front and putting it in the unoccupied passenger seat never occurs to him. "You leave it alone," he tells them again, and hops back behind the wheel. He slams the door, takes a brief glance in the rearview mirror, sees two old ladies back there. He didn't notice them before because he wasn't exactly looking at the road when he passed them. Gives them a wave they never see through the caravan's filthy rear window, and then pulls back onto Route 7. Now the radio is playing Gangsta Dream 19 by Outrageous, and Brian turns it up, once more swerving across the white line and into the northbound lane as he does so. This is the sort of person who simply cannot fix the radio without looking at it. Rap rules, and metal rules too. All he needs now to make his day complete is a tune by Ozzy. Crazy Train would be good. And some of those Mars's bars. 16. Mrs. Tassenbaum came bolting out of the Carol Laff's driveway and onto Turtleback Lane in second gear, the old pickup truck's engine over-cranking, If there'd been an RPM gauge on the dashboard, the needle would undoubtedly have been redlining, the few tools in the back tap-dancing crazily in the rusty bed. Roland had only a bit of the touch, hardly any at all compared to Jake, but he had met Stephen King and taken him down into the false sleep of hypnosis. That was a powerful bond to share, and so he wasn't entirely surprised when he touched the mind Jake hadn't been able to reach. It probably didn't hurt that King was thinking about them. He often does on his walks, Roland thought. When he's alone, he hears the song of the turtle and knows that he has a job to do, one he's shirking. Well, my friend, that ends today. If, that was, they could save him. He leaned past Jake and looked at the woman. Can't you make this God's cursed thing go faster?
Yes, she said, I believe I can.
And then to Jake, can you really read minds, son, or is that only a game you and your friend play?
I can't read them exactly, but I can touch them, Jake said. I hope to hell that's the truth, she said, because Turtleback's hilly and only one lane wide in places. If you send someone coming the other way, you have to let me know.
I will.
Excellent, said Irene Tassenbaum.
She bared her teeth in a grin. Really, there was no longer any doubt. This was the best thing that had ever happened to her, the most exciting thing. Now, as well as hearing those singing voices, she could see faces in the leaves of the trees on the sides of the road, as if they were being watched by a multitude. She could feel some tremendous force gathering all around them, and she was possessed by a sudden giddy notion that if she floored the gas pedal of Chip McAvoy's old rusty pickup, it might go faster than the speed of light. Powered by the energy she sensed around them, it might outrace time itself.
Well, let's just see about that, she thought.
She swung the IH into the middle of Turtleback Lane, then punched the clutch and yanked the gear shift into third. The old truck didn't go faster than the speed of light, and it didn't outrace time, but the speedometer needle climbed to 50 and then passed. The truck crested a hill, and when it started down the other side, it flew briefly into the air. At least someone was happy. Irene Tassenbaum shouted in excitement. 17. Stephen King takes two walks, the short one and the long one. The short one takes him out to the intersection of Warrington's Road and Route 7, then back to his house, Carol laughs, the same way. That one is 3 miles. The long walk, which also happens to be the name of a book he once wrote under the Bachman name back before the world moved on, takes him past the Warrington's intersection, down Route 7, as far as the Slab City Road, then all the way back Route 7 to Berry Hill, bypassing Warrington's Road. This walk returns him to his house by way of the north end of Turtleback Lane, and is 4 miles. This is the one he means to take today, but when he gets back to the intersection of 7 and Warrington's, he stops, playing with the idea of going back the short way. He's always careful about walking on the shoulder of the public road, though traffic is light on Route 7, even in summer. The only time this highway ever gets busy is when the Freiburg Fair's going on, and that doesn't start until the first week of October. Most of the sight lines are good anyway. If a bad driver's coming, or a drunk, you can usually spot him half a mile away, which gives you plenty of time to vacate the area. There's only one blind hill, and that's the one directly beyond the Warrington's intersection. Yet that's also an aerobic hill, one that gets the old heart really pumping, and isn't that what he's doing all these stupid walks for? To promote what the TV talking heads call heart healthiness? He's quit drinking, he's quit doping, he's almost quit smoking, he exercises, what else is there? Yet a voice whispers to him just the same. Get off the main road, it says. Go on back to the house. You'll have an extra hour before you have to meet the rest of them for the party on the other side of the lake. You can do some work, maybe start the next Dark Tower story. You know it's been on your mind. Aye, so it has, but he already has a story to work on, and he likes it fine. Going back to the tail of the tower means swimming in deep water, maybe drowning there. Yet he suddenly realizes, standing here at this crossroads, that if he goes back early, he will begin. He won't be able to help himself. He'll have to listen to what he sometimes thinks of as Veska Gan, the song of the turtle, and sometimes as Susanna's song. He'll junk the current story, turn his back on the safety of the land, and swim out into that dark water once again. He's done it 4 times before, but this time he'll have to swim all the way to the other side. Swim or drown.
No, he says. He speaks aloud, and why not? There's no one to hear him out here.
He perceives, faintly, the attenuate sound of an approaching vehicle. Or is it two? One on Route 7 and one on Warrington's Road? But that's all.
No, he says again. I'm going to walk and then I'm going to party. No more riding today, especially not that.
And so, leaving the intersection behind, he begins making his way up the steep hill with its short sightline. He begins to walk toward the sound of the oncoming Dodge Caravan, which is also the sound of his oncoming death. The Ka of the rational world wants him dead. That of the Prim wants him alive and singing his song. So it is that on this sunny afternoon in western Maine, the irresistible force rushes toward the immovable object, and for the first time since the Prim receded, all worlds and all existence turn toward the dark tower which stands at the far end of Kankanore, which is to say, the red fields of none. Even the Crimson King ceases his angry screaming, for it is the dark tower that will decide.
Resolution demands a sacrifice, King says. And although no one hears but the birds, and he has no idea what this means, he is not disturbed. He's always muttering to himself. It's as though there is a cave of voices in his head, one full of brilliant, but not necessarily intelligent, mimics. He walks, swinging his arms beside his blue-jeaned thighs, unaware that his heart isn't finishing its last few beats, that his mind isn't thinking its last few thoughts, that his voices aren't making their last Delphic pronouncements. "This Ka Gan," he says, amused by the sound of it, yet attracted, too. He has promised himself that he'll try not to stuff his Dark Tower fantasies with unpronounceable words in some made-up, not to say fucked-up language. His editor, Chuck Verrill in New York, will only cut most of them if he does. But his mind seems to be filling up with such words and phrases all the same. Ka, Ka-Tet, Sai, So, Kantoi. That one, at least, is from another book of his, Desperation. Tahin. Kantokin's Kirith Ungol and H.P. Lovecraft's great blind fiddler Nyarlathotep be far behind. He laughs, then begins to sing a song one of his voices has given him. He thinks he will certainly use it in the next Gunslinger book when he finally allows the turtle its voice again. Kamala, come one, he sings as he walks. There's a young man with a gun. That young man lost his honey when she took it on the run. And is that young man Eddie Dean? Or is it Jake Chambers?
Eddie, he says out loud. Eddie's the gunny with the honey. He's so deep in thought that at first he doesn't see the roof of the blue Dodge Caravan as it comes over the short horizon ahead of him, and so does not realize this vehicle is not on the highway at all, but on the soft shoulder where he is walking. Nor does he hear the oncoming roar of the pickup truck behind him. 18. Brian hears the scrape of the cooler's lid even over the funky rip-rap beat of the music. And when he looks in the rearview mirror, he's both dismayed and outraged to see that Bullet, always the more forward of the two Rotties, has leaped from the storage area at the rear of the van into the passenger compartment. Bullet's rear legs are up on the dirty seat, his stubby tail is wagging happily, and his nose is buried in Brian's cooler. At this point, any reasonable driver would pull over to the side of the road, stop his vehicle, and take care of his wayward animal. Brian Smith, however, has never gotten high marks for reason when behind the wheel, and has the driving record to prove it. Instead of pulling over, he twists around to the right, steering with his left hand and shoving ineffectually at the top of the Rottweiler's flat head with his right. "Leave it alone!" he shouts at Bullet as his minivan drifts first toward the right-hand shoulder and then onto it. "Didn't you hear me, Bullet? Are you foolish? Leave it alone!" He actually succeeds in shoving the dog's head up for a moment, but there's no fur for his fingers to grasp, and Bullet, while no genius, is smart enough to know he has at least one more chance to grab the stuff in the white paper, the stuff radiating that entrancing red smell. He dips beneath Brian's hand and seizes the wrapped package of hamburger in his jaws.
"Drop it!" Brian screams. "You drop it right now!"
In order to gain the purchase necessary to twist further in the driver's bucket, he presses down firmly with both feet. One of them, unfortunately, is on the accelerator. The van puts on a burst of speed as it rushes toward the top of the hill. At this moment, in his excitement and outrage, Brian has completely forgotten where he is, Route 7, and what he's supposed to be doing, driving a van. All he cares about is getting the package of meat out of Bullet's jaws.
"Gimme it!" he shouts, tugging.
Tail wagging more furiously than ever, to him it's now a game as well as a meal, Bullet tugs back. There's the sound of ripping butcher's paper. The van is now all the way off the road. Beyond it is a grove of old pines, lit by lovely afternoon light. A haze of green and gold. Brian thinks only of the meat. He's not going to eat hamburger with dog drool on it, and you best believe it.
"Gimme it!"
he says, not seeing the man in the path of his van. Not seeing the truck that is now pulled up just behind the man. Not seeing the truck's passenger door open, or the lanky cowboy type who leaps out, a revolver with big yellow grips spilling from the holster on his hip and onto the ground as he does. Brian Smith's world has narrowed to one very bad dog and one package of meat. In the struggle for the meat, blood roses are blooming on the butcher's paper like tattoos. 19. "There he is," the boy named Jake shouted, but Irene Tassenbaum didn't need him to tell her. Stephen King was wearing jeans, a chambray work shirt, and a baseball cap. He was well beyond the place where the road to Warrington's intersected with Route 7, about a quarter of the way up the slope. She punched the clutch, downshifted to second like a NASCAR driver with the checkered flag in view, then turned hard left, hauling on the wheel with both hands. Chip McAvoy's pickup truck teetered but did not roll. She saw the twinkle of sun on metal as a vehicle coming the other way reached the top of the hill King was climbing. She heard the man sitting by the door shout, "Pull in behind him!" She did as he told her, even though she could now see that the oncoming vehicle was off the road and thus apt to broadside them, not to mention crushing Stephen King in a metal sandwich between them. The door popped open, and the one named Roland half rolled, half jumped out of the truck. After that, things happened very, very fast. Chapter 2. Veska Gan. 1. What happened was lethally simple. Roland's bad hip betrayed him. He went to his knees with a cry of mingled rage, pain, and dismay. Then the sunlight was blotted out as Jake leaped over him without so much as breaking stride. Oi was barking crazily from the cab of the truck, "Ache! Ache! Ache! Ache!"
"Jake, no!" Roland shouted.
He saw it all with a terrible clarity. The boy seized the rider around the waist as the blue vehicle, neither a truck nor a car but seemingly a cross between the two, bore down upon them in a roar of dissonant music. Jake turned King to the left, shielding him with his body. And so it was Jake the vehicle struck. Behind the gunslinger, who was now on his knees with his bleeding hands buried in the dirt, the woman from the store screamed.
"Jake, no!"
Roland bellowed again, but it was too late. The boy he thought of as his son disappeared beneath the blue vehicle. The gunslinger saw one small upraised hand, would never forget it, and then that was gone too. King, struck first by Jake and then by the weight of the van behind Jake, was thrown to the edge of the little grove of trees 10 feet from the point of impact. He landed on his right side, hitting his head on a stone hard enough to send the cap flying from his head. Then he rolled over, perhaps intending to try for his feet, or perhaps intending nothing at all. His eyes were shocked zeros. The driver hauled on his vehicle steering wheel, and it slipped past on Roland's left, missing him by inches, merely throwing dust into his face instead of running him down. By then it was slowing, the driver perhaps applying the machine's brake now that it was too late. The side squalled across the hood of the pickup truck, slowing the van further, but it was not done doing damage even so. Before coming to a complete stop, it struck King again, this time as he lay on the ground. Roland heard the snap of a breaking bone. It was followed by the rider's cry of pain. And now Roland knew for sure about the pain in his own hip, didn't he? It had never been dry twist at all. He scrambled to his feet, only peripherally aware that his pain was entirely gone. He looked at Stephen King's unnaturally twisted body beneath the left front wheel of the blue vehicle and thought, "Good," with unthinking savagery, "good. If someone has to die here, let it be you. To hell with Gann's navel. To hell with the stories that come out of it. To hell with the tower. Let it be you, and not my boy." The bumbler raced past Roland to where Jake lay on his back at the rear of the van, with blue exhaust blowing into his open eyes. Hoy did not hesitate. He seized the Oriza pouch that was still slung over Jake's shoulder and used it to pull the boy away from the van, doing it inch by inch, his short, strong legs digging up puffs of dust. Blood was pouring from Jake's ears and the corners of his mouth. The heels of his shore boots left a double line of tracks in the dirt and crisp brown pine needles. Roland staggered to Jake and fell on his knees beside him. His first thought was that Jake was all right after all. The boy's limbs were straight, thank all the gods, and the mark running across the bridge of his nose and down one beardless cheek was oil-flecked with rust, not blood as Roland had first assumed. There was blood coming out of his ears, yes, and his mouth, too. But the latter stream might only be flowing from a cut in the lining of his cheek, or, "Go and see to the rider," Jake said. His voice was calm, not at all constricted by pain. They might have been sitting around a little cook fire after a day on the trail, waiting for what Eddie liked to call vittles, or, if he happened to be feeling particularly humorous, as he often was, whittles. "The rider can wait," Roland said curtly, thinking, "I've been given a miracle. One made by the combination of a boy's yielding, not quite finished body and the soft earth that gave beneath him when that bastard's truckomobile ran over him."
"No," Jake said, "he can't."
And when he moved, trying to sit up, his shirt pulled a little tighter against the top half of his body, and Roland saw the dreadful concavity of the boy's chest. More blood poured from Jake's mouth, and when he tried to speak again, he began to cough instead. Roland's heart seemed to twist like a rag inside his chest, and there was a moment to wonder how it could possibly go on beating in the face of this. Hoy voiced a moaning cry, Jake's name expressed in a half-howl that made Roland's arms burst out in gooseflesh.
"Don't try to talk," Roland said. "Something may be sprung inside of you, a rib, mayhap two."
Jake turned his head to the side. He spat out a mouthful of blood. Some of it ran down his cheek like chewing tobacco, and took a hold on Roland's wrist. His grip was strong, so was his voice, each word clear.
"Everything sprung. This is dying. I know because I've done it before."
What he said next was what Roland had been thinking just before they started out from Kara Laughs.
"If Ka will say so, let it be so. See to the man we came to save."
It was impossible to deny the imperative in the boy's eyes and voice. It was done now. The Ka of 19 played out to the end. Except, perhaps, for King, the man they had come to save. How much of their fate had danced from the tips of his flying, tobacco-stained fingers? All? Some? This? Whatever the answer, Roland could have killed him with his bare hands as he lay pinned beneath the machine that had struck him, and never mind that King hadn't been driving the van. If he had been doing what Ka had meant him to be doing, he never would have been here when the fool came calling, and Jake's chest wouldn't have that terrible sunken look. It was too much, coming so soon after Eddie had been bushwhacked. "And yet, don't move," he said, getting up. "Oi, don't let him move."
"I won't move."
Every word still clear, still sure. But now Roland could see blood also darkening the bottom of Jake's shirt and the crotch of his jeans, blooming there like roses. Once before, he died and had come back. But not from this world. And this one, death was always for keeps. Roland turned to where the rider lay. 2. When Brian Smith tried to get out from behind the wheel of his van,
Irene Tassenbaum pushed him rudely back in. His dogs, perhaps smelling blood or oi or both, were barking and capering wildly behind him. Now the radio was pounding out some new and utterly hellish heavy metal tune. She thought her head would split, not from the shock of what had just happened, but from pure racket. She saw the man's revolver lying on the ground and picked it up. The small part of her mind, still capable of coherent thought, was amazed by the weight of the thing. Nevertheless, she pointed it at the man, then reached past him and punched the power button on the radio. With the blaring fuzz-tone guitars gone, she could hear birds as well as two barking dogs and one howling, well, one howling whatever it was.
"Back your van off the guy you hit," she said, slowly. "And if you run over the kid again when you do it, I swear I'll blow your jackass head off."
Brian Smith stared at her with bloodshot, bewildered eyes.
"What kid?" he asked.